How's it going, y'all?
I'm
Joey. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic and drug addict. I brought my big book with a few places I may refer to at some point. In case I run out of things to say, I can just start reading out of it. I don't know why. Public speaking, I've gotten a little bit more used to it. I've told my story a few times, and I've experienced it in my professional line of work, and it gets a little bit easier every time, but I have to admit, when I was driving over here, I started getting that kind of feeling in my stomach, like, I think I'm going to puke, maybe. So it'll probably take me about 2-3 minutes to get over my jitters, but hopefully I can get that cranked up. Thanks for introducing me, Kurt. We invited Kurt and tricked him into introducing me, so he didn't know that was going to happen. But, you know, when service calls, you answer. I do have a very... I love Austin Recovery. I'm actually an alumni here. And my story goes, I've been to rehab, or I've been to a treatment twice, if you only count the times that I went to inpatient. Austin Recovery is the last inpatient I had to go to. And I came to detox for the second time to Austin Recovery in June 8th of 2011, and I've been sober ever since. I think I might have set a record. I'd have to double check that one on how quickly I left detox and then came right back. Because I got out on what holiday is right before then? At the end of, is it Memorial Day? At the end of May? Yeah. I got out of Memorial Day. And they, you know, when I was walking out, they had tried to convince me to go to a 30-day program. I didn't want to go, and so I left and went home and took some Suboxones that were at my house. And 3 days later, I was shooting dope again. And I called up, and there was a lady in the admissions back then. There was detox was up at Cross Park, and. And I didn't have any money at the time. I was a state funded, you know, through detox, through both detoxes and through the 30-day program I went to. So, you know, I called in begging the lady that answered the phone. I said, I can't do this. Like, I've been gone for 3 days. I'm shooting dope again. I'm not going to make it. You know, I need to come back. And thankfully, they said, you know, be here Monday. You know, and I came. They stopped me at the intake or whatever, and the lady sat me down, and she was like, "You were here like a week ago." But you can't just keep coming to detox every other week. She was like, "Matter of fact, if you don't go to rehab after this 30-day inpatient, I'm not letting you back. I'm not letting you back in here." I took her seriously, and. In the position I was in, that was big to me because I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know? This is the only place I had to go, was here. But thankfully, they let me in. I don't know at what point I decided to just shut my mouth and start listening, but it happened. And I started taking advice and taking instructions. And that's when things started to get better for me. So I actually grew up not too far from here. I went to Hayes High School. I was a class of 2002. I didn't graduate. Got kicked out my senior year for being a dumbass. I'm going to try not to cuss too much. I forget there's kids in here. I can't make a promise that won't happen again. Anyways, so just to qualify myself, and I'll try not to go on and on and on with drunkologues, they say to... when you're telling your story, you know, you say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And the first time I did this, I thought, oh, man, I'm never going to be able to fill up 40 minutes of time. And usually by the time you get through, you think you're halfway through, and you look at the clock, and it's time to sit down. So I'm going to try to watch the clock and try not to do that. But I think it's important to qualify yourself, you know, to qualify myself as an alcoholic and a drug addict. And so I grew up, like I said, not too far from here. I was in the Hays School District. I grew up in, I guess, a lower middle class family. We didn't have a lot of money, but I never went hungry, you know, if that puts anything in her perspective. It was a pretty turbulent home environment. Both of my parents were at the minimum hard drinkers and hard users, if not towards the alcoholic spectrum. It's really hard to say. That's really for them to decide. But so I grew up with it in the home. I grew up with a lot of screaming and a lot of violence, which, you know, I've forgiven my parents for that through this program. They were very young when they had me. My mom was 17 years old. My dad was 20, 21, you know. I just think back of, like, I'm 34 now, you know, and what kind of knucklehead I was when I was 17 to 21. Like, I'm thankful I didn't have any kids back then, because I would have ruined them too, you know. But anyways, so my dad always complained about money, and so he worked really hard, and he just never really made it very well. And he came from a family. His dad was a judge and really successful in the town he was in, and an attorney. And so he came from an upper middle class family. And for him to have to come and this is me looking at it from his perspective and trying to understand where he was coming from. You know, he didn't have much, and he worked really hard for it, and he was always stressed about money. And so that's all I ever heard when I was growing up, was money, 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 money. And I was a straight-A student all the way up until the time that I kind of, pretty much until the time I started doing drugs. But I just never saw, like, a future for me in education, you know. I didn't know that it was possible to, like, get a loan, you know, or to, like, I didn't know these things. I just thought, because my dad always said, there's no college money, you're not, you know. So I was like, well, what's the point? You know, what's the point? So when I was about 12, 13 years old, I think that's pretty common age for people to kind of start experimenting. But anyways, that's when the first time I smoked weed. And I always felt like I was a little bit out of place. I never felt, like, really comfortable in my own skin. I found pot was the first thing I started doing when I was like 12 or 13. And man, I tell you, when I found that, it was like, man, I found, like, my mission, you know. This is going to be my life from here on out. And it was for quite some time, you know. I felt that sense of ease and comfort. I was able to talk to people as I would be myself and feel like myself and feel. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel nervous. You know, it solved all my problems, really. And so I started doing that early in junior high, and getting into early high school, I started randomly experimenting with different drugs. I'd say every single drug that I ever went to, I have I'd have to say I have an OCD personality, but every single drug I ever went and did, I did for like 6 months straight, you know what I mean? Like, I'd find something and be like, oh, that's great, I'm going to do this for 6 months straight. Or this is great, I'm going to do this for like a year. And that seemed to work okay for me. And I also discovered that I could make a lot of money selling drugs. And so all through high school, that's all I did, you know? I sold drugs, and I was trying to get out of my house, really, is what I wanted. I wanted to get out of the crazy situation that I was in. I didn't know how else to do it. I tried getting a job at minimum wage back then was like $5 an hour or something like that. I got a job doing that. I was like, man, this is never going to work. So I just kept on doing what I was doing. I don't know that I ever thought anything other than that was my goal, was to be like a successful freaking drug dealer. You know what I mean? Like, that was my life's mission. And so all through that time, I was using, you know, this and that, using weed, acid, LSD, mushrooms, ecstasy. But there was a... I know it's a lot different now because I see it all the time, and I saw it when I came into treatment. But what ended up really taking me down was heroin. And when I was in high school, heroin wasn't, like, really a thing. You know what I mean? I knew like two kids that did heroin, and they were like complete losers, and you didn't do it. You know? Like, you didn't do that, right? But I know that's like everybody does it now. Like, it's very popular in the young crowd, which is terrifying. You know, there's people dying from it daily. Matter of fact, on that note, I've lost at least 4 pretty good friends of mine in the last 2 months from overdoses. And it's so interesting because like 2 weeks before my friend Abdul died, I had watched a documentary on Netflix about this like fentanyl crap or whatever, and I was like, man, that's crazy. There's this little town the size of San Marcos, and they said that they had someone die every shift on EMS from an overdose of fentanyl. I was like, dude, that's so crazy. Because when you're doing heroin, you know, and you have a strong habit or whatever, for the most part, you know, you're not usually going to just OD and die, you know, unless you do like a whole lot. But on average, it's a lot less common for people who have a pretty strong habit. You know what I mean? Most of the time people OD, back from what I remember when I was doing it, is they had quit doing it for a while, or they got sober for a while and then got out of treatment, they do a shot and die. That's pretty common. But for people to have like a habit and just die from a regular dose was super uncommon. But that's not uncommon anymore with this new stuff that's out. And it's like 2 weeks I saw that documentary, and 2 weeks my friend died. The very next morning, another friend of mine died. These are people that I went to high school with that I knew my whole life, right? I grew up with these people, back to back, dead. 2 weeks later, dead. Another 2 weeks later, dead. These are just the ones that I know by name, like people that I was close to. There's other ones that you hear about that it's just like, oh, such and did you know such and such, he died. Such and such, he died. Such and such, he died. It's like, what the hell is going on around here? So apparently it doesn't get any better out there, you know? It's one thing to keep in mind. I'm probably going to be a little bit, I'm usually pretty happy-go-lucky guy, but it's been a kind of a rough year for me, and specifically today I had to go to a funeral to wake, of a friend of mine that died in a car wreck on Tuesday. This guy died on Tuesday. His brother in Houston died in his sleep the next day. It's like, what the heck happened? But he just died in his sleep. I know what kind of stuff he used to do. I don't know. That was a long time ago. I'm just assuming it was another fentanyl overdose. So, I mean, this stuff's happening left and right. If you open your ears, I'm sure you've heard about it in the community. It's very dangerous. This is a life or death thing for me. It's a life or death thing for anybody here, especially if you're into that type of stuff. But it doesn't matter. Drunk driving, you know, you can die any kind of way from this disease. You know, you don't have to necessarily be an IV heroin user to die from this disease. I lost 2 friends in pretty early recovery, in their early 50s, from cirrhosis. Man, they just drank themselves to death. I took my friend Jay he said he needed a ride to the liquor store. He didn't have a car. I was like, I was sober, like I didn't drink anymore, but I was like, that dude needs a couple errands. All right, grocery store, liquor store. Dude comes out with a box like this big full of half gallons. I was like, of vodka. I was like, dude, was that like a year's supply or what? No, it was like a couple freaking days supply, you know? Next thing you know, he gets cirrhosis of the liver, he dies, his girlfriend dies freaking year later, something like that. Early 50s, mid-50s. Chris let me know he's recording this, so if I step too far away from this, you won't be able to hear me. But anyway, so, you know, I actually became pretty successful in the weed selling game, you know. This was, so I'm 34. This was, I would say, when I got, like, to a pretty good spot was about 12 years ago. And I met this kid that lived in California. He was FedExing me stuff. Like, he was FedExing me stuff. What's really interesting now is that kid lives here, and he's sober now, and he's freaking kicking butt. In sobriety, in recovery. I saw him the other day chairing a meeting. But Interesting how that happens. But I don't think it was as popular as it became. That was like before it was like mainstream to do that, so it was a lot easier to get away with. But like I was doing pretty good. The whole time after I got out of high school, I had a job. I had a full-time job. And I think that what the full-time job did for me is it kept me from becoming a full-blown, maniacal, everyday hard drug user, you know. On the weekends, I was like a weekend warrior. On the weekends, it was just all bets are off. You know, I might stay up all weekend doing meth, come back, leave Friday, come back to work still awake on Monday, you know, type of thing. But I always went. And so I think that kind of kept a little bit of a rein on me. And had I not had that job, I probably would have fallen off a lot sooner than I did, which wasn't very long. I was 22 years old whenever I completely lost my mind. So anyways, it's not like I made it very far, right? But so what ended up happening is I broke my foot, falling off of a cliff at Pace Bend Park up here at Lake Travis, drunk as hell, taking a bunch of pills. And I didn't work anymore. I was out of work for like 3 months because I couldn't work. I had a physical job. I couldn't do it, so I was out of work. And during that time, I started like industrializing my freaking weed business, you know? And I was making so much money. It was like, I make like $2,000 a day at home. I make like $2,000 a month at work. Work's getting in the way. I ain't going back to work. But during that time, man, I had so much time on my hands. All I was doing is doing that, you know, and pretty much for me, I had to do a lot of drugs or I just did them. I don't know why I did them. I don't really know why I did them. I didn't have control over it. That's what I ended up learning. It talks about that in this book. It talks about this trying to overcome this phenomenon of craving, right? That becomes paramount to everything else. Everything else. And you may not even know what's happening. I didn't know what was happening. I had no freaking clue. I thought I was just doing it because I wanted to or whatever, you know? But anyway, so I did meth during that time and for about, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 months, maybe a year. And one day I ended up staying up for like 12 or 14 days or something. I can't really remember. I completely lost my mind. I don't know how many days it was. That's the best I can recall. But I was like a complete psychopath for like 3 or 4 days. Like I thought there was a party going on at my house. There was nobody there. Everybody had ran off, you know. The last thing I remember is I had shot my pistol at some shadow trees. And luckily I lived out in the country. And one of my last friends was there. And he like lit a freaking thing of black cats, threw it out the window, out the door to kind of make it, I guess, like a distraction. Like, oh, that's what that was. It wasn't a bunch of gunshots. It was just firecrackers. And he was like, screw this, I'm out of here. You know? And he left. So I think there's like 50 people at my house. I don't even remember what. And I think there's people like drilling through my roof and like SWAT everywhere. Like, it's crazy, dude. I mean, God. Sounds like some of y'all have been there. Yeah. It's not fun. It's just like pure freaking terror, like scared the whole time. What is fun about that? You know what I mean? It's like, oh, helicopters are chasing me. I don't know. Maybe they were. I don't think they were. It did happen to a friend of mine, like legit, but he's doing 15 feds. So, I mean, like, when the helicopters are chasing you, it's over. Like, I'm sorry. You're not going to see those people coming. You're not. You're not going to see them coming. They're going to freaking kick your door in and they're going to screw you over so bad you're not going to know what hit you. Right? And that's what happens. That's what happened to him. I think he's going to get out in, like, the next year or two from last I heard. But anyways, dude was pretty cool. It's really a shame what happened. At the time, he was on the news, and he got called having the most sophisticated drug operation they had ever seen. Right? He had like 500 plants growing in a house here in Buda, and he had like a pound of meth at his house. So whatever. I guess that was pretty sophisticated. He was an electrician, so he like stole. I don't know what he did, but he was stealing the power to get around the meter somehow. You know what I mean? Because that's the big deal when you're growing weed. It's like you're using a bunch of power, right? I don't know what he did, but he was stealing the power. But I always thought that was really cool because I had this dude had gotten me these night vision goggles, like a friend of mine that was in the military, and I called him, like manipulative as I am, and I was like, "Hey man, you know anybody that's into like tactical gear?" He was like, "Yeah, me." And I was like, "Yeah, I bet you got a lot of money too. Why don't you come see what I got?" So anyways, I sold them to him, and they ended up on the freaking news. And I was like, "Those are mine!" Oh, man. But luckily, we took the serial numbers off. I don't think they could have traced them back to me anyway. But, no, it's just craziness, man, craziness. So, I don't know, I'm like 22 years old, on top of the world, making more money than I know what to do with, doing more meth than a human being should be doing. And somehow there were some people at my house, and they were sniffing some heroin in the kitchen, and somehow I was like, "Hey, I want to try that." And they're like, "No, you don't." And I was like, "Yeah, I do. Sure, I do. And I did. And it was, I don't know what happened, but 6 months later, I was not out on the back porch for 4 to 6 months. I really don't know what happened. I was asleep the majority of the time, I suppose, or half asleep. All my clothes had freaking holes, like burn holes in them. And I woke up and I was like, I had this safe with this pile of money in it. And I was making a pile of money. Like, next thing I knew, I had an eviction notice on my door and all my money was gone. And I was like, "What the hell happened?" Like, really? It's been like a week, right? No, it had been too long, man, and, you know, it was a business, but it was an illegitimate business, but it was a business. I happen to own my own business now, and I can tell you right now, if I stop answering the phone for my customers for 6 months, they're going to call somebody else, you know? And that's what happened. So that kind of started, like, my just downward, like, spiral. I was able to kind of quit doing the speed and the heroin. I couldn't get this monkey off my back. I tried for like, I think it was, I started doing it when I was 22. I got sober when I was like 27. So those whole 5 years I was like trying to quit. Because I tried to quit after like the first 3 or 4 months of doing it. That was the first time I quit. Like I went to the doctor, they gave me some pills and I slept for like 3 or 4 days. I woke up, I was fine. That was the easy one. That's like the one easy one you get, you know. It just gets worse and worse after that, in my experience. So, let's see. We got 20 minutes in? Yeah. So I'm going to get a little bit past the drunkalogs. Do I seem like I might be a drug addict? Maybe? Possibly? All right. So fast forward a little bit. I went to rehab once in 2008? Or nine. I'm not really good with remembering years. But anyways, I guess it was probably closer to 10. So I went to rehab for 3 months in Waco. I really didn't want to quit. I just wanted to stop doing the hard stuff and get my old life back. That's what I really wanted. And so it didn't work. You know, I went for 3 months. I got out, and pretty quickly I was drinking. Next thing you know, I was using dope again. And I did that for about 8 months, and I was just kicking myself in the butt, you know. I threw all my AA coins like at the wall when I realized I woke up one day and I was strung out on dope again, and I couldn't believe it happened to me again. But it's exactly what everybody said was going to happen to me, but I didn't want to believe them. And so that's when I went to Austin Recovery for the first time. I went for a week to detox. I got out, I relapsed really quickly, I came back, right? I came back with a different attitude, you know. I came back knowing that my ideas weren't going to work, none of them, not even any of them, and that I was just going to have to shut up and start doing what people tell me to do, whether I like it or not. You know, I didn't like it. It's a really hard thing. It's a really hard thing to go from, like, this is my entire life, to your entire life is going to be completely different. You know what I mean? It's not an easy thing to get to. Step one is the hardest step to get over. It really is. Getting there is the hardest thing to do, in my experience. To finally realize that you're just effed. That's what I call the first step, the I'm effed step. You got no chance, you know? Got no chance. I got a body that can't handle it and a mind that just won't leave it alone. And so I go to detox, go to 30-day, and like 2 weeks in, my counselors double-team me, and they're like, what are you going to do, dude? I was like, I don't know, dude. You tell me, you know? And so they were like, well, this is what we think you should do. This, 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 and this. You need to get out. You need to get a sober house. You need to get a sponsor. I already had a sponsor. You need to, you know, get after it. And there was some period in that 2 weeks that I was reading this book, and I had read it before. But there was something that just stood out to me that just made me laugh. And I finally got it. Because I was always under the assumption that my problem was the way I grew up, my parents, my circumstances. You know, like I said, my parents were drug addicts. They lived in a turbulent family. Everybody I knew did heroin, which I came to find out was not the case. I used to think everybody did it. No, it wasn't the case. Everybody I knew did it. But, like, not that many people really do it. In perspective of the entire human population, right? But I never knew, like, what the freaking problem was. I never knew what it was. And then one day I was reading page 62. Like, I had read up to there, and then I got to page 62, and it screams these two words, selfishness, self-centeredness. And all this other time up until then, it's kind of real nice, the book. And then it's like, no, dude, you're the problem. And I was like, son of a bitch. It's me. And I couldn't believe it. I laughed at myself. I was like, I'm doing this to myself. Why? Right? But there is actually something liberating in that, right? Because I was living the rest of my life as a victim. And as long as you live your life as a victim, you will always be able to find somebody or something or some circumstance to victimize you and to keep you a victim. But when you have a say in what happens in your own life, and you can make your own choices regardless of your circumstances or the cards that you were dealt, there's a lot of power in that. A lot of power. And I don't live my life a victim today if I can help it. I have to keep practicing these principles. I have to stay in the program. And that's how I remain not a victim, right? Because it's real easy to just pick up a resentment and not even know that I have it, and then start hating everybody and start treating everybody around me badly, right? And then I start living as a victim again, right? So what I have to do on a consistent basis is to look at my part of my wrongs in the relationships and in the situations that I encounter in a day-to-day life. And trust me, they're there, you know? I've been doing this for 7 years, and I can't think of any time where I've sat down to do an inventory and I didn't have anything to put on there. And I didn't have anything to admit that I had screwed up on. You know, there always is. There's always something. But I remember when I went to treatment. They told me to do this, 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 and this. On day one, I got out. I called my sponsor, and he said, all right, I'm going to come pick you up. So he came and picked me up from the treatment center on day one. We went to a meeting at Western Trails. We sat there for like 10 or 15 minutes. He looked at me and was like, this dude's had enough meetings. We don't need any more meetings. We left the meeting. We went out in the car where, in my experience, most step work happens in the car. So we sat there and we started going through the book. And that was a friend that dropped me off at detox. I didn't even ask him to be my sponsor. He just decided he was going to be my sponsor, and that was that. Right? But that is kind of how it went in the old days, you know. It's like, hey, here's your sponsor. This is what you're going to do. You don't know anything. And it's true. It's true. All right? We don't know anything. If I knew anything, why am I in detox 2 times in 3 weeks? Right? Clueless. Okay? So we went out and we started working the steps. And within 2 weeks, I was making amends. Right? And there were some hours and hours spent late nights doing fourth and fifth step. You know? Fourth and fifth step is huge. Fourth and fifth step is when I realize, like, what I'm doing and how it's affecting me and how everybody is controlling me. Everybody around me, all my circumstances around me, they're controlling me. I'm not in control. I'm just letting them win, you know? I'm drinking after these people. I'm getting high at these people. And they don't even know. You know, they don't even care, you know? The Big Book lays this out so simply, and this is such a simple program, and it's so simple that we even tend to complicate it, and it's not complicated. But there is a part in the book that says we assume, of course, that the reader desires to stay sober, right? So, of course, when I first got sober, I wanted to save everybody. Nope. You know, I turn my attention to people who want help, you know. Because there's plenty of people out there that need it. There's not a lot of people out there that want it, you know. It's available. It's available for anybody. I mean, I can't even describe the circumstances that I put myself in during my drinking and using. But I couldn't stop it. It was the disaster. My life was a disaster. I would not be alive today if it weren't for quitting and getting sober. I can promise you that. So that part really stuck out to me. There's another part that I wanted to... that'll be later. So anyways, so I get out, bang out the steps, and I do what I'm supposed to do. When I went in to recovery, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this with every fiber of my being for 12 months. If it doesn't work, I'm going to kill myself, because that's where I was at. I didn't have any other choice. Like, I had exhausted every available option that I could see other than this, you know. But I had seen this. It was presented to me, and that's why I think it's important to come and talk to people in treatment centers and to do service work and to carry the message, because I remember being in a treatment center, and the people that came and talked spoke to me more than just about it. It meant more to me than just about anything else, and so it is very important. So I thank Chris for inviting me to be here. It means a lot. I've had a rough year the last year. You know, life is life. But in the grand scheme of things are going pretty good. I left last weekend. I went down to Port Alto and fished a fishing tournament in Matagorda Bay. So like a year ago, I met some people down there. My friend, the friend that I have now that lives down there, he's been sober for like 11 years now. So that's how we ended up getting to know each other. I go fishing there all the time now. It's like my new favorite hobby. But anyways, I got a bunch of stuff here that I'm trying to deal with. You know, real big problems. Like, I need to move into the house that I just bought. You know, like, oh man, that sucks, right? I have jobs that I need to go do. Like, I own my own business. Like, I have more work than I know what to do with right now. Such a terrible problem, right? And I told my friend that. I was like, all right, I'm going to, on my way back to my effed up life. And he was like, dude, you don't have an effed up life. We know what an effed up life is, and you don't have one. And that's what I started to think about on the way home. I was like, yeah, you're right, dude. I'm ungrateful SOB. That's what I am. So I was like, I might need to put that on a piece of paper. Call somebody about that one. But, you know, today, drinking and drugging is just not a part of my life anymore. It's not something that I hide from. It's not something that I think about. It's out there. If you want it, it's there. You know, you can't hide from it. And that's the thing. That's the thing I learned from you. You can't hide from this stuff, man. You're not going to be able to hide from it. So what do you do? You have to find a solution that will protect you in all circumstances, right? So this program promised me that I would have the ability to go where other free men may go with freedom from disaster, right? If I follow a few simple rules, right? And there's just a few simple rules. It's really not hard, but a price has to be paid, you know? So that my troubles are of my own making. So what do I do about that? Well, I do step four. I figure out what I'm doing, why I'm stepping on the toes of my fellows and they're retaliating, and I look at it. And it was laughable. It was almost laughable doing my fourth step and fifth step. I was like, well, no wonder all this crap's happening to me. I'm a piece of shit. <You know? laughs> I am. I really am. But I didn't think I was. And it says that in the big book. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. All right? I didn't do anything. I was just standing there. Oh, really? Let's tell me the whole story, right? So that's a big revelation. But I think, and I will, and it was always stressed to me. See, I'm already down to 5 minutes, like 6 minutes. I didn't get through like 10% of my life story, right? Quickly today, I'm an arborist. I own my own company. I'm 50% owner with my father. I employ usually three people on the tree crew. We've got two pest control trucks. We just ordered another pest control truck. I just bought a home. My realtor's sitting back here. She helped me close on it after almost getting into a really bad deal with a realtor, with a previous realtor that I thought I could trust, and luckily I got out of it. Got a girlfriend with a beautiful daughter. I have a relationship with both my parents, a good relationship with both my parents. I have a key to my dad's door, you know? I have a key to my dad's house. I can go anytime I want. He doesn't care. Do whatever. To his trucks, cars, whatever. You know what I mean? People trust me. I have friends that I can count on. Kurt's one of my best friends. And I met him through the program, you know? So the promise of finding friends, lifetime friends in the program, that promise came true too. The past couple years, I've been really busy with work, and I've shied away from the program, and I haven't been participating in it nearly as much as I should, and I felt guilty about that. But it's so weird because that's a beautiful thing about AA. And whether you kind of don't come for whatever reason, or you don't come because you relapse, all you got to do is walk back in the door, you know? And it's like you're home again, you know? And you don't have to just keep on suffering. You can just walk back in. And you're welcomed with open arms, and people give you jobs to do, you know? They ask you to come do service commitments. And that's part of the camaraderie that we have, you know? There's no judgment. There's nothing but help, love. That's all I've experienced in this program. I can't even think about. I mean, I have so much to do during the day that doesn't involve, has nothing to do with getting high or using drugs. I usually by the end of the day, I'm just ready for bed. You know, there's so many cool things that you can do besides drugs and alcohol, and that was really sort of the really hard things that I couldn't quite comprehend. Another thing I couldn't comprehend was like. I used to be obsessed with money. I used to be. I might still be a little bit. I don't know. Might need to work on that. But, you know, you go from making a ton of money selling dope, and you hear this a lot of times with people in prison that go to prison for selling dope, and they get out, and they're like, oh, guess what? You get a job washing dishes. You know, that doesn't work out for people. They end up going back to the game and doing that again. Because it's hard to go back to a life. It's hard, right, to do that when you're accustomed to a certain lifestyle. But it's, you know, it takes some humility. It takes some humility to get this thing anyways. So it doesn't hurt you. But, heck, I don't even worry about that anymore. My business has been pretty successful for a junky you know, tree service guy from freaking Kyle, Texas. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not running a Fortune 500 company, but I'm doing okay. You know, I'm not worried about where my next meal is going to come from. I'm not worried about how I'm going to pay my bills at all, you know. Matter of fact, I just ordered a pretty freaking expensive boat. And I don't say that because, like, I'm trying to brag about it. I'm just saying, like, I didn't see the possibilities in my life before I came here. My sponsor did. He was sober like seven or he got sober when he was 17. He's my age. We played t-ball together. And he would tell me that because I was trying to start. Yeah, he was trying to start my own business, right? We used to use together too. But he pulled his head out of his ass when he was like 17. I just kept on going. But he was a little bit further down the progressive scale, I think. He had almost died like five times in like a month, so flipped like two or three cars, you know, whatever. It took me a while to get to that point. But anyways, people that have been around this program, that have seen the miracles, I don't care what your circumstances are, you know. If you want to put a ceiling on what you think that you can accomplish, then you do, go ahead and do that. But I'm not. And the reason I'm not doing it is because it wasn't done for me. I put this cap of like, I'm never going to be past like this successful, you know. But then but people around me that have been around, especially my sponsor who plays a big role in my recovery, was like, dude, you know how to run a business. You ran a business for like 10 years. It was illegal, so now you got to learn how to pay taxes and stuff now. But you know, it's the same thing. You know, it's still the same thing. You got to have more money coming in than you do coming out. And so you got to have a product that people want to buy. I mean, it's not that, it's business is business, you know. And so those words of encouragement from people like him kept me going. You know, and he was right. He was like, because I don't even advertise. I don't advertise one bit. It's just word of mouth business. Austin is freaking booming, you know. We live in what I haven't traveled all over the world. I don't know if this is the greatest country in the world, but I know it ain't bad. I know there's a hell of a lot worse places that we could be, you know. So there's really, the sky's the limit for anybody. You know, if I could do it, anybody could do it. And I've seen people pull themselves up from the freaking mire and become successful members of society. I have a friend in the program that was in prison, and she just graduated from law school. You know? What the heck? You know? It's crazy. I see people that are like, oh, I got a felony, I can't get an apartment. But they practice their principles, they stay close to God, and hey, they get an apartment. You know? I have another friend that he's got felonies out the wazoo. When he got out, he was washing dishes for $8 an hour. Now he has a job at the city of Austin. You're not supposed to be able to work there. He's got felonies. How did that happen? I don't know. You know, but it happens. So I stick around these programs. I stick around these rooms because I see what the alternative is, man. I've seen what the alternative is for the last couple months. Very close-handed. It's not pretty. It's not pretty. I lost my brother to this disease. He died of an overdose. Actually, that is a real quick point I wanted to make is about the funeral I went to. The funeral home I went to today is where my brother's wake was held in 2007, I believe it was. I'm so bad with dates. I think it was 2007. And at the time, when my brother died, the only answer I had at the time was to do a bunch of dope. I was not able to be there for my family. And matter of fact, all I did was cause them more grief than they needed after this had already happened, you know. And so then when I walked in today to that funeral home, I had my head held high. I was able to be there for my friend and his family. And I thank God for that. So, thank you.